This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, soon-to-be-retired host of this show, and spending my last few days in this role listening back to some memorable conversations from the last 15 years. Today, it's a man who reshaped the way we talk about history. When John Hope Franklin chaired President Clinton's initiative on race in the 1990s, he started with what he called the naivete that often accompanies optimism, that he could be either naive or optimistic after documenting the long struggle for civil rights is remarkable and was no doubt the kind of optimism born of intellectual integrity and an open mind. Almost from the time he was born in Oklahoma in 1915, John Hope Franklin encountered racism. As a six-year-old, he was thrown off a train for sitting in a whites-only coach, and that same year, his father's law practice was burned to the ground during the infamous Tulsa race riot. When he was 19, he was nearly lynched in Mississippi. When he was a graduate student at Harvard, he was denied service at a restaurant, denied a home loan at the age of 45. And on the very night he received the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 1995, he was mistaken for a coat check attendant. John Hope Franklin pursued one of the most remarkable academic careers of the 20th century. He was valedictorian at Booker T. Washington High School, attended Fisk University for undergrad, and earned a Ph.D. at Harvard. He went on to become the first black professor to chair a department at a predominantly white university when he joined the faculty of Brooklyn College in 1956, and that was before moving to the University of Chicago and finally Duke University. In 1947, he published From Slavery to Freedom, The History of the Negro in America. It quickly became the definitive history of African Americans and sold more than 3 million copies before his death. He wrote or edited almost 20 other books, including his autobiography called Mirror to America. John Hope Franklin passed away in 2009. I consider my conversation with him 3 years earlier one of the high points of my career. We took listener calls on this show. Obviously, we're not taking them today. I started by asking Dr. Franklin to tell me about his father.
He was an extraordinarily optimistic person, and he always looked on the bright side of things. After experiencing what he did, I couldn't understand why he did, but I certainly appreciated the fact that he was a perennial optimist who had faith in mankind, faith in his neighbors, faith in people all around him.
Well, one of the most remarkable moments in the book comes very early on when you describe your father's experience in a courtroom in Shreveport, Louisiana, where he dares to stand up to defend a client and is, you described the episode for us. But it strikes me that afterward, when he encountered this racist judge, and I'd like you to tell the whole story, that he was surprised.
My father was practicing law in Ardmore, Oklahoma at the time. He had a client there who had a legal matter in Shreveport, Louisiana. And my father and his client traveled to Shreveport and were present in the courtroom when the judge or the bailiff called the case, so-and-so against so-and-so, and my father stood. And the judge said, "You back there, what are you standing for?" And my father said, rather blandly, said, "I'm representing Jones in this matter." And the judge, in a look of wonderment, I suppose, said, no nigger represents anyone in my court. Now you get out." And my father, somewhat dismayed, but not terribly discouraged, withdrew.
You said that he was surprised at that. Why, I find it almost difficult to believe that a man, this is 1911, wouldn't have expected that kind of reaction.
No, he wouldn't have. As I said, he was a perennial optimist, and he thought that having passed the bar and having settled into the practice of law, which theoretically protects the human being and preserves the legal rights of all people. He was surprised that he was ejected from the court so unceremoniously. I was always amazed, even as a youngster, teenager, I was always amazed that my father had so much faith in people.
When he tells you that story, I assume he came home and told it, or you heard shortly thereafter, is there any sense of bitterness, any sense of anger when he's telling the story?
No, there's not. Of course, I was not born when the incident occurred, but it was repeated from time to time in the family. And incidents like that, as well as that incident, were reviewed and rehashed. And he told all those stories without the slightest trace of bitterness or anger. And I admired him for it. I don't say that I always emulated him, but I did admire him for his control and his optimism. We used to argue about his faith in the progress of the human species and that sort of thing. And I didn't have as much faith then, and I told him so. And he thought that it was terrible for a youngster like me to always look on the bright side.
Well, your mother, too, showed a great deal of strength and perseverance. There was the time that you ended up thrown off a train because of her refusal to go into the Negro coach.
Yes. She would not go for the simple reason that the train was moving. And she said, these children are small. I cannot risk injuring them by trying to move them while the train is moving. And she said, I'll stop the train. She thought he stopped the train in order to permit us to move to the small half Negro coach and half baggage coach. And we got up and planned to move to the next coach, and he put us off the train.
That must be a moment. Was that the first moment that you encountered that raw edge of racism?
Yes, it is. And I didn't do anything but burst into crying. Yeah. 6 years old, out in the woods, trying to find our way through the thickets and jungle, sort of jungle arrangement, I began to cry. And my mother said, what are you crying about? I said, he put us off the train. And she said, oh, that? And she very calmly told me that I was wasting my energy and my time lamenting that. She said, don't cry about that. Use that energy that you are crying with. Use that to prove that you're as good as anyone on that train.
Do you find yourself at moments like that sort of making up your mind, making a plan of one sort or another?
Well, I find myself remembering her admonition, her instruction. And I find myself being determined not to let it get the best of me. And I would then determine to prove that I was as good as anyone on that train or as good as anyone in that school or as good as anyone anywhere.
So you did eventually make it through school. You go to Fisk University in 1931. Tell us about Fisk in 1931.
Well, Fisk was a very rapidly growing intellectual center for the education of young African Americans in 1931. My mother and my father had gone to Roger Williams University, which was a Baptist college in that town, and they had met there. And but Roger Williams University had gone on hard times and wasn't doing well and was finally to close. They wanted me to go back into that part of the country for my education, but they knew that it wasn't Roger Williams by that time. And my brother had gone to Fisk, and they decided to send me to Fisk. There was never any question about if I should go to college, despite the fact that we were without resources of much of any kind. It was not a question of if we should go to college. It was a question of where we would go. And they would work their fingers to the bone they would go to almost any length to make certain that we did go to college.
How do you make that decision? Were there big debates about which schools?
No, there wasn't. There might have been a debate about where my brother should go or where my sister should go. My brother went to Fisk University. My sister went to West Virginia State. So I wanted to follow my brother. And he had gone to Fisk and was very successful as an undergraduate, popular, very powerful in the fraternity, that sort of thing. So that I wanted to emulate him, and I went. I went with great glee, and they thought that was a good idea.
And you went to Fisk, and it was there where you met, in fact, it was a white history professor that may have had a very strong influence on your decision to become a history scholar.
He had every influence on my decision to become a historian. It was Theodore S. Currier. He was himself a graduate of Harvard University, undergraduate, University of Maine. Then he got a master's degree in history from Harvard. And he published early and became popular, became influential, and was hired by the president of Fisk to come down and build the history department at Fisk University. And so this young white professor, just 12 years older than I was handling the history at Fisk University when I went there in 1931.
I'm remembering my conversation with the late John Hope Franklin. Just ahead, we'll hear more about what drove him to write The Untold History of Blacks in America. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, listening back to a conversation with the late John Hope Franklin. In his autobiography, Mirror to America, he recounts his life as a scholar, author, husband, and father. He began his academic career with a book titled The Free Negro in North Carolina. He would later return to the state as a professor at Duke University. It's among the most memorable conversations that I've had as host of this show for nearly 15 years. We took listener calls on this show. It's recorded, obviously not taking them today. I asked Dr. Franklin to tell me what made his mentor at Fisk University such an influential teacher.
Perhaps you appreciate the fact that in high school, history was usually taught by the coach. They filled out his program by letting him teach a few courses in history. And I had a view of history which was very dim when I went to Fisk. I was going to take some courses in contemporary civilization, in which there were some lectures by the historian. This man came in, Ted Currier came into the program, and he began the lecture, and I said that this isn't the kind of history I've been listening to in high school. And so I perked up and began to listen to it. He was a man, first he was very animated, and that was, for a 16-year-old, that was very important. He made things move. He moved himself, prancing up and down in front of the class, and bringing to life those periods in history which I thought were dead and gone forever. He brought them back, whether they were about some royal family in England or about some problem, some religious conflict in Spain or Italy. He brought all this alive in a way that I had never heard it before. And not only were they kings and queens, they were ordinary people, working class people and so forth, all making up the society, you see. And I said, this is something. I didn't know history could be like this. And I was excited from that moment on.
When did you get the first inkling that the story that was being told, the history of African Americans in this country, had been mistold, undertold, and needed to be more?
I got that, I suppose it was in my junior or senior year as an undergraduate. While Professor Currier, as a white man from New England, had no real firsthand knowledge of African American history, he encouraged me to study it, and particularly for my honors thesis when I was a senior, I wrote a paper on free Negroes in the antebellum South, and that gave me an opportunity not merely to confront the problem of writing about African Americans, but it also gave me the experience that I would need sorely later on. To go into an archive, as I went to the Tennessee Historical Society and worked in primary documents, even when I was 15 and 16, you see. And that gave me an experience and an exhilarating challenge that I didn't overcome very easily.
Well, the challenge is just getting at the stacks.
Right, right.
I mean, there were actually segregated, when you talk about going into the state archives in North Carolina, segregated stacks.
Yes. That was not true, and that was what was all the more confusing. It was not true in Tennessee, and I could go into Sacks in Tennessee. I could not go into Sacks in North Carolina. I could not go in. I could not even go to the archives in Louisiana. So you see, it was so much confusion about where an African-American could go and what he could do, you see. And this showed me the inconsistency and the contradiction and the indecision on the part of whites. They didn't know what to do. They did one thing in North Carolina, another thing in Louisiana, another thing in Tennessee. And it certainly convinced me that there was some flimsy excuses being offered.
Dale is on the line from High Point. Hello, Dale.
Good morning. I appreciate you taking my call. Dr. Franklin, you're sort of a hero of mine. It is because of you and people like you that I was inspired to study history and look at history from a point of view other than just what the textbook said. And I found excitement, pretty much the kind of excitement I hear in your voice when speaking about historical matters. My question is to you, as a black man in America, how do you feel about so-called Black History Month?
Well, I took the position, even with Dr. Woodson, Dr. Carter Woodson, who was founded Black History Month in 1926, I took the position then, as I do now, that African-American history is so important that it cannot be confined to a month, that it ought to be integrated into the whole complete story of the history of this country. And until it is done, we don't have a complete history of the United States. So that the emphasis in one month is one that distresses me, because it tends to imply that well, we'll do this in February, and then we'll get it over with, and we'll go on back to the history we usually teach. So I say that Black History Month ought to be every month of the year. And I tend to decline to speak during the month of February, because I don't want people to think that I have succumbed to the idea that we can dispose of Black history one month and then go get back to the real history. The real history is every month, and the real history is the total history, not merely of white people, but of black people as well.
And at the time that you recognized these inconsistencies and the hypocrisy, as you say, and the difficulty that whites were having in sort of how to manage this thing called segregation, did you at that moment think that scholarship, that historical research was going to be part of the answer? Or did you for one moment think, oh, no, I have to go in another direction, maybe activism, something else?
No, I thought that it was very, very important that scholarship should address the question. I wasn't turning my back on activism or anything else, but scholarship is a form of activism, is a form of correction of the story as it has been told for all these decades and centuries. So that to the extent that you tend to tell the story differently or to revise the story, you yourself become an activist.
And, of course, the most important work, I would say, in that regard would be your work on from slavery to freedom,
yes,
which upended many of the notions about Reconstruction and race relations. Tell us a little bit about what you thought was going to happen and how you thought that book might be received as you started the project.
I don't know that I did much thinking about how it should be received. If one did not have his ear to the ground, if one did not know and appreciate and understand the fact that something else was going on that was difficult to discern, one couldn't predict what the impact this book would have had or could have had. When I was asked to write From Slavery to Freedom by Alfred Knopf and his staff at the publishers, I don't think they knew that there was anything different, except that at the end of World War II, there would be people who want to know something about what blacks had done and what blacks had been and how they had functioned during the war and so forth. And the publishers were very strong in their belief that this book would at least arouse some interest and attract some attention and perhaps sell some copies, which they were interested in doing. And they persuaded me to write this book. I had no interest in addressing this problem. I thought maybe someday I would, but I had no interest in doing it in 1945 when they approached me. And I told them, thank you, but no thank you. That's what my attitude. And they kept pressing me and said, look, this book we know will sell. We know this, that, the other. And so they finally persuaded me by promising me that they would stand behind me and that they would give me an advance and royalties and so forth. They persuaded me that to drop things which I was doing and to write this book, which I did in 1946. And it came out the next year in 1947.
So there's a publisher asking an African-American scholar to write about African-American history, but you resisted this, as you say, even in your undergraduate or while you were working on your doctorate at Harvard University.
Yes.
You wanted to write about Edward Bellamy, of all folks, and your professor suggested you might take another topic.
Well, he thought perhaps I might like to write on some Negro subject, and I said, no, I'm going to write on Edward Bellamy, and so I did. Oh.
What drew your interest to Edward Bellamy? He's a utopian, social critic, a utopian novelist.
He was a revisionist, shall we say. Yeah. He wanted to do something about the injustices in society. And that struck me as very germane to what I was thinking about and trying to do. And so I was attracted to Edward Bellamy. And particularly after I met his wife, he'd been dead since 1898, but I met Mrs. Bellamy, and she opened all the materials to me and let me do the research as though I was a mature and seasoned researcher. I was just an undergraduate. I mean, I was just a graduate student at Harvard at the time, maybe about 23 or 24 years old, and yet she treated me as though I were a real pro, and I deeply appreciated that. And she even went so far as to say that she was going to give me the chance to write the biography of Edward Bellamy if it was not finished by the person who was going to do that, who had already contracted to do it. Well, he did succeed in completing the biography, and I was not privileged to do it. But it did give me a sense of confidence in myself, a sense of confidence in the ability to use history as a force in creating new attitudes toward social and intellectual problems.
Have you seen evidence where the revisions in history and scholarship have actually had an impact on social progress?
Yes, I have. Not nearly as much as I would like to see, but I saw it in the way in which I was privileged to participate in the adjudication of cases. For example, in the case of Lyman Johnson against the University of Kentucky in 1948, I used the experience, or the lack of experience, of the University of Kentucky in promoting history on a broad scale and in admitting African Americans to the program in history there. I saw the kind of discrimination that would result in all people, not merely blacks, but all people, not knowing as much about history as they should know. And so when Thurgood Marshall asked me to serve as the expert witness in that case in 1948 in Lyman Johnson against the University of Kentucky, I was able to prove that in not having the opportunity to study at the University of Kentucky, Lyman Johnson was deprived of his rights. Not merely as a historian, but as a human being, as an African-American human being. He was deprived of his rights to participate in advancing his own knowledge, to say nothing of the knowledge that he might disseminate to others. He was deprived by law in the university, in the state of Kentucky.
And you also write about if the complete history is to be told and the entire story of the African-American experience is to be told, it's also about factionalism and about divisions and prejudice within the race, beginning at Rentisville, the black community that your father moved into in Oklahoma. And you have a couple of experiences yourself when you get to Harvard and you meet with, was it the NAACP, members there who didn't want to hear from a Southern?
Yes. You see, what I have discovered, if I ever didn't know it, is that prejudice knows no bounds. It's not, white people don't have a monopoly on it, blacks have their prejudices too. My mother and father were mistaken. It was thought that they were Baptists because they both had been to Baptist college. And when they came to Rentisville, they found that the place was dominated by Baptists, and when they went to a Methodist church the first Sunday they were in Rentisville, that was the beginning of the end for them, because people did not think that they should be affiliated with
them. When your father was a Democrat, too.
Yes. And
that didn't help.
That's right. That didn't help at all either. So that you learn very early all about these things, and surely I learned about about the power that one can exercise by using his objectivity and his intellectual strength to tell all sides and to reject the notion that any one group has a monopoly on truth or anything else.
Were you surprised when you went to St. Augustine College that the president there, Edgar Gould, you write about this in your book, about the stern warning he gave you when you came there with your PhD, something you felt that you should be proud of?
Well, I didn't have my PhD when I got there, but I completed it when I was there, and I was the first person on the faculty ever to hold a PhD degree. And then when he learned that I had completed the work for the PhD, he called me in, and instead of congratulating me, he then upbraided me, gave me a lecture about how I should act and what I should do and what my attitude should be, and I thought that was rather strange. I was a person of some humility and some modesty, and I didn't think I needed to be lectured along those lines. And yet he felt that I did, and I was sorely disappointed that he felt that I did not know my place in the community where I had struggled and worked so hard and tried to build it up. And yet here's a man who tells me that he's not, that he doesn't have any faith in me, doesn't have any confidence in what I should do and how I should act once that I'm a PhD. And I left with some degree of sadness from that experience.
Michael is on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Michael.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Dr. Franklin, I'm just glad and just impressed of the achievement that you have gone through in the last several decades. My number one question, I think you already answered sort of the reverse racism, but what I'm troubled with is the word African-American. I have a trouble in the sense that even though I spent some time in Europe and I've had some black African good friends, they don't see us as Africans. They see us as American blacks. And my question is, why is it that the elite professors like yourself are drumming this word of Afro-American down most of black Americans' throat in order to beat your chest to say that you're Africans, whereby that, from what I can see, we're Americans. To be an African, and like most Africans would say, you would really have to study the culture of Africa. Mm. And since we are so many generations removed from our ancestry of slavery, we have assimilated in this country thus far. Most Africans look upon us as European blacks.
All right, Michael, that's a good question. Let's get a response. Thank you, Michael.
I don't know what your notion is about what a black is. Let's remember that the designation of some kind of some statement before you use the word American is a census designation. That is, we're you're known in the census as African or as black or as African-American or whatever. It's not, nobody's trying to ram that down the throat of anyone. I don't care what you call me. I don't care what I'm called. I know who I am. I know what I am. And to deny that you have African ancestry is to deny the truth.
My conversation with the late John Hope Franklin from 2006 continues in a moment. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, continuing this archived conversation with the late John Hope Franklin. He reshaped our understanding of American history and helped to create the field of African American studies. We took listener calls on this show, but it's recorded, so obviously not taking them today. Among his many honors, Dr. Franklin won the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And long before that, he was the first African-American to chair a department at a predominantly white college. I asked him about the significance of his appointment at Brooklyn College.
When I went to Howard University in 1947, that was regarded as the last stage, as the last point that African-American scholar could achieve. There's no way else to go. You've had it. You've gone there. And I was invited to be a full professor there when I was 32 years old. And there was some question in my mind of whether I should accept the last stage, the last stops, you see. I hesitated, but not too long, because I thought maybe I wouldn't get this chance again and I'd better go. But they all were vastly distinguished professors at Howard University. People who could eclipse many scholars and many so-called white universities, but they couldn't go. They were there. They were there. That was the end of it. And it did make for, on the one hand, a very fine intellectual climate, because there they all were right there, and I had access to them. They were my colleagues, my friends. But it was not healthy in the sense that they knew that a curtain had come down before them and they couldn't go anywhere. And that was not healthy. You always want to look up and see that you can gain something yet. And so I was persuaded that I wouldn't ever go somewhere from Howard, but I was driven by some desire that I wanted to be as good as anyone else, and recognized as good. That's my mother's admonition to me when I'm 6 years old. So I kept scrambling around and publishing and going to all the meetings and pushing myself in, sometimes where I wasn't wanted, but I just had to do it. I traveled abroad. I went to conferences. I went to international congresses. I was helping in Germany rewrite the textbooks after Hitler's time, you see, that sort of thing. And I did come to the attention then of some people who were in a particular position to promote my name at Brooklyn College. And I ran into them, got friendly with them in Rome in 1955. And they needed a chair, and they said, well, why not have Franklin? And they went back and reported that and convinced the department and the Board of Higher Education of the City of New York that I should be nominated for that position of chairman of the Department of History and professor of history. There were 52 white people in the department at the time, and I was the only black person, or African-American, or whatever this gentleman who wants to call me, who was talking on the radio earlier. So I became the professor and chairman of the department.
I'm talking with John Hope Franklin, his autobiography, Mirror to America. Daniel's on the line from Greensboro. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, how are you doing? Mr. Franklin, I've very much enjoyed hearing you speak.
Thank you.
So I guess as a historian who has gone through many levels of higher education throughout your life and then gone on to study kind of the history of African-American achievement in higher education throughout kind of the history of this country, I have a question for you as a young college student. I actually go to Stanford right now.
and someone who is getting ready to go out into the work world, become a young professional. What do you see as things that people like myself can do in order to support and uplift the younger generation of African Americans that we see coming through, you know, primary school and secondary school today, in order to kind of build a foundation and build kind of a next generation of black achievers in America?
That's a very good question. It's a question which bedevils me all the time. What can we do? How can we encourage the young people who are going to be in following in our steps? I would say, first of all, it is not possible for you to hold up high enough a standard of scholarship to which they should adhere. By that I mean to tell them that, first of all, they must be uncompromising, careful scholars of integrity and of determination and of discipline. It takes a lot. It takes a lot to do what you want to do in this life. I worked 3 jobs when I was in college. I wouldn't want that to happen to anybody, but I did. I worked 2 jobs when I was at Harvard until I won fellowships, which forbade my teaching, my working at all. One must not be afraid of sacrificing and of struggling, working hard, and setting before himself or herself the highest standards of scholarship that there are. And then if one does that, one can be certain that the power of his intellect and of his or her intellect, the power of his or her discipline, will land them somewhere beyond where they are.
Let's take a look, though, at this, a deeper look at this question of scholarship. You certainly came up at a time when scholarship had its, we understood what scholarship was, it was trusted, and everybody knew that it led to a conclusion. Now there are deep questions. There was a review of one of your books that said, in an era when many scholars are questioning whether it's possible to identify any foundations for truth or scholarly objectivity, John Hope Franklin offers a compelling case for continuing to struggle toward these goals. What is that case? Have we come to a point where there are so many conflicting bodies of scholarship now, bodies, that we have a right to question?
I don't think we have come to that point. And if we have, there's nothing wrong with that, of seeing and debating the route that we should take. I'm always willing to accept the challenge that this is not the way, but some other way is the way. And I would argue that my way, whatever it is, whatever way I want to choose, is an acceptable way. And one can move with great ease and assurance up the ladder, across the field, or wherever one goes. One can do that if one has these qualities of commitment, and of study, and of determination, and of a willingness to sacrifice, whatever it is. And I concede that there are those who feel that there are divisions within the field of scholarship that take one in one direction, take someone else in another direction. That doesn't disturb me as much as those people who don't want to go in any direction, who don't feel committed to go into any direction. I think that what's important is that we should have the discipline and have the commitment and have the desire and have the confidence in ourselves that we can do what needs to be done.
Is the scholarship compromised in any way when it becomes politicized? I'm thinking about people like Cornel West, Michael Eric Dyson, who have been criticized from time to time of politicizing the scholarship. And of course, there are others from other areas, but I'm speaking now about African Americans.
There's always the danger that one would be criticized for politicizing scholarship when they get out into the activist role and the activist field. I won't say whether Dyson or the others are politicizing it to a point of being ineffectual. They move in a direction that I don't choose to move in. I'm not saying that they are wrong. It's just that I have tested my own procedures and found them satisfactory to me. They might find my procedures unsatisfactory to them. They're welcome to be critical of me, and they're welcome to go their own way. I find, though, that people who are critical of the Dysons and the others and of me are people who are not committed to doing anything very significant or successful. So it takes many oars to row a boat to safety and to victory, and I have no problem with the others, as long as they are seeking to raise the level of intellectual and scholarly endeavor, as long as they are willing and anxious to improve the lot of mankind. They can do it in any way that they want to do it.
Certainly one of the proactive projects you took on was to chair President Clinton's initiative on race. It was to be a national discussion about race in America. As we said at the opening of the show, you began with a kind of optimism. How did that end up for you?
Well, it ended up that I was a wiser man. our function was widely misunderstood. President Clinton, for whatever he appointed us to do, did not appoint us to solve the race problem in the United States. And many people did think that that's what we were appointed to do. And therefore, they felt that we were a failure from the outset. We failed to solve the race problem, to be sure, but that's not what we were set out to do. We were asked to start and conduct and supervise a widespread conversation on race. And I think we did that. Not only did we do it in a very general way, we did it in a very specific way. We created several hundred institutions, organizations, which carried on these dialogues, these conversations about race. And we made recommendations to the president and to various other groups of what they should do in order to move us a few notches on toward the solution of the problems which we faced. I would like to observe that there are some of these institutions that we sponsored or helped to create that are still in existence, despite the fact that there's been no mention of this sort of thing in the last 5 years. But some of the things we started are still ongoing, and I'm proud that they are. And to the extent that they are, they're contributing toward the resolution of some of the problems which we face in the area of race.
Michael is on the line in Henderson. Hello, Michael.
Hi. And I guess my question now is to Mr. Franklin, Dr. Franklin, I'm sorry. What do you feel is the state of Black America today? Well, more importantly, the state of the young Black America. What do you see the, our direction, or how do you feel our direction is heading? Where do you think we're headed now?
Thank you, Mike.
I tackle this to some extent in the last chapter of my book, the so-called epilogue. The answer to your question is I don't know. But I would say that so far as creating a climate, a better climate, a climate more hospitable to the acceptance of people on the basis of their talents and their abilities, that climate has improved. I don't think there's any question about it. Sometimes we don't recognize that fact. Sometimes we don't even know that it has improved, but I think it has improved. It's simply not improved enough. I would say further that if we could put a little more effort into it, and if we could, at the same time, perhaps more modestly acknowledge the fact that that discipline, hard work, and conscientious commitment to the improvement of conditions, if we could just simply undertake those things, I think we'll move toward the resolution of some of these problems.
What form does that effort take?
It takes goodwill. It takes some modesty. It takes some commitment to energetic and long-suffering commitment to improving ourselves personally.
I just want to stop you there for a moment because you talked about the improvement that you've seen. You write in the book that beginning with in the 1980s, Reagan's New Beginning, that an increase to tolerance for intolerance in this country. And so do you think things have improved somewhat since then, since those days? Is it a kind of thing that ebbs and flows?
It ebbs and flows, to be sure. Whether that has improved totally, whether there's more improvement than retrogression is another question. I would simply say that we have now on the table a chance to move forward very effectively, and that chance must be understood and seen by people who are at least committed to making some improvement. And if they are committed, I think that the chances are fairly good that we can move.
The late John Hope Franklin, who was a professor emeritus at Duke University when he passed away in 2009. My conversation with him in 2006 is one of the most memorable I've had as host of this program in nearly 15 years. You can catch more of my picks every Tuesday and Thursday through the end of the year. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.